the trash people throw all the belongings into the back of the dump truck. shopping cart, milk crate, clothes, you name it. And then they crushed it and police just drove on.
And has your organization or Coalition on Homelessness filed any kind of complaints about this form of behavior in the last year or two?
Yes, we do so on a regular basis. One thing we've been doing for people is filing OCC complaints. For the property confiscations, we've been doing small claims cases for people. In the past, Street Watch has been successful in getting money back for people whose property has been taken.
Really? And what's the length of that process? How long does it take a homeless person to go through small claims court to get his property, shall we say, if not back, then paid for?
The experience has been, if we accept, what we've done so far is accept settlements from the city. They've taken approximately 4 to 6 months to materialize, and we've usually gotten back about 60%. The way that I've seen a couple of cases done is the city offered to give 60% of the monetary value of the property claimed in settlement. And that's taken 4 to 6 months. And those amounts were like, some of them were like $300, some of them like $400, along those lines. But that's about as quick as they can.
Any attempt to secure an injunction against the compacting of people's property and its destruction by city dump trucks?
An attempt really hasn't been made, because the police and the city, basically this routine property confiscation, are basically not saying it's happening. Their policies don't allow this conduct to go on. It's like for to get some sort of restraining order, it'd be,
but surely,
in other words, the same reason we can't get a restraining order is the same reason we can't get them to inform their own policies. There's a certain amount of denial going on the reality of what's actually happening.
But you have video camera people who are out there showing that these incidents are occurring. Are they claiming these are all rogue cops or mistakes? I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, Timothy. I'm just trying to get a sense of solutions we might try down here in Santa Cruz, for instance, you know.
Basically, what happens is they'll say one thing or another. Basically, what we've been finding is, in an attempt to get them to stop doing this, we've been getting massive runarounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, an incident happened up at Golden Gate Park. This happened like 2 months ago at Albert Lake, where the police, right around when the little section in the front closed, deliberately ran everybody out. Then after they did, and they left their shopping carts behind, it was like 9 of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were all together as a group, and they rolled. Well, it happened 10 o'clock at night. The police rolled into Albert Lake with like a dump truck and like 3 or 4 police cars, ran everybody out, then went over to the property and started throwing it out, the shopping carts, one by one. When the homeless people tried to go back and get their stuff, the police threatened them with arrest if they got onto the cart property.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff was crushed right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
We do the small claims. We talk to the city's attorney. We tell the city attorney that their property was thrown out. The city attorney was like, oh, according to the police, it was trash.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're like, well, no, it was their property. So it's like, oh, so it's like...
Was a video documentary made of this? Do you have a video record of what happened?
No. And when we have the video records of the actual times, if we ever get like a real clear cut case, then they say it's an exception.
I see. Let me switch to another subject. How's the squatting scene? You yourself are a squatter. Is squatting increasingly tolerated? Is it increasingly effective? Or is there any change in the Brown administration's policy, or independently of the Willie Brown administration, is the new mayor? Is it happening more frequently because of housing needs and just the inclination of the people to do it?
I think that squatting has been relatively unaffected by the city's policy towards homeless during the last couple of years. Basically, since people who are squatting, they're off the street and out of sight, the city's satisfied.
How many people would you say are squatting in San Francisco?
I would I would estimate, it's so...
Hundreds,
it's
thousands?
It's difficult to say. I would say, personally, of people that I know of who, like, squat either on a regular basis or off and on, I would say about, 75.
Mm-hmm. So it's actually, you'd say that, and of the people you don't know, in a wild guess?
I would say I'd say a couple hundred.
Now, what's Homes Not Jails, the activist organization, doing to try to reclaim unused city property, unused and derelict private property for housing use by poor people?
And that was an interview yesterday with Coalition on Homelessness Street Watch activist Timothy Matchock, who has been following that quite closely. Apparently he passes it every day as he goes into work in the Tenderloin District, where the Coalition on Homelessness office in San Francisco is located. And, you know, we've had in the past lots of similar behavior by the Santa Cruz police, though not so much that has been reported to me recently. It used to be quite the practice for police to seize and destroy bedding and possessions of homeless people, particularly those engaging in protest actions such as that happened at the post office homeless table, which was a 24-hour protest that endured for 8.5 months at the corner of Front and Water Streets, right near the post office on that corner, under the leadership of Jabberwocky J. Green, Linda the Lark Edwards, Moonrise Mike Carrero, Rainbow Light Austin, and others. And that's all kind of history, and at some point I'd like to kind of play you some history, because I think to understand what we're doing now, we have to understand what succeeded, what failed in the past, and where we're coming from, where we're going. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, and the calling lines are open and working, I might add, 427-3772. In the studio with me, as I mentioned to you earlier, we have a Food Not Bombs worker who's been taking on more responsibility lately, getting the food out, and the weather has been turning wetter, so I imagine it's been getting more difficult. And in fact, some of us are curious where you're serving in wet weather. I know I was looking for the Food Not Bombs place last weekend or the weekend before, and I guess we weren't able to find it. I know that in wet weather on the mall on Wednesdays, I guess you serve under the metro awning if there's a problem. Is that right, D-Bob?
Yeah.
Come on in and get real close to the mic. You have to be like this far away. Where's Food Not Bombs serving on the weekends? Food Not Bombs, of course, as everybody knows, serves free food at least three times a week in meals at 1 o'clock, normally at River and Josephine Streets across from Stapleton on Saturday and Sundays, and at Hippie Corner, Cathcart and Pacific at 4 o'clock. Is it 4 o'clock or is it 5 o'clock?
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock on Wednesday.
We have enough help.
Right. So actually, that means that's an issue, I take it. You need more help, right?
The root of the problem in Food Not Bombs in Santa Cruz, as I see it, is a result of four things. Lack of motivation, a need for volunteers, lack of knowledge and skills of some who do volunteer, and the attitude of the people we serve to take advantage of and disrespect the organization. An example of that is leaving a mess of trash and food scraps, which I usually get stuck with cleaning up. Lack of knowledge and skills can be remedied through training, but the rest requires motivated people. I have been told that my presence in Food Not Bombs is the reason that there are very few volunteers. And I refuse to take that rap and that crap. People are responsible for their own initiative, and I can't make them do anything. I'm doing the best I can, but I'm not going to continue much longer under the existing conditions. So if there's interest in keeping Food Not Bombs going in this town, we need more volunteers.
I hear you. That's a pretty clear message out there, folks. If you want to see Food Not Bombs continuing, you've got to be out there chopping those vegetables, finding kitchens, finding vehicles to transport the food, helping to clean up, helping to serve food. And how can people volunteer, D-Bob?
showing up and being motivated.
And is there a number that they can call, for example, if they're up at the university and they want to help, but they can't get down to any particular meal, but would like to somehow be involved?
The number for the voicemail is 425-3345.
So that's 425-3345 if you want to help with Food Not Bombs. And there are really a lot of things you can do. I mostly in the propaganda department, I show up and, you know, give out flyers and help to litter the area, unfortunately, which D-Bob then has to clean up by distributing a lot of flyers, although I feel that's important anyway because I think those issues should be gotten out. But there are many things that you can do. As I said, they need people to help cook, they need people to help serve, they need people to help clean up, they need people, vehicles, kitchens, people to do phone work, people to do fundraising events. Food Not Bombs frequently uses rummage sales to try to get money. And speaking of money, I'm going to put in a quick pitch here for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Last I heard, the phone was due to be turned off today. Yes, folks, the telephone was due to be turned off today unless $90 was secured. Now, this is not me trying to get a slush fund for my old age or, you know, a partying fund down here in the studio. If you want the station to be able to hear you on the air when you call in, we need $90. I think actually we've secured 40 or 50 of it, but there's still some that I think is unsecured. In fact, if anyone who is associated with the Treasury Department or knows more about this issue can call in and give us some specific updates, I would be grateful because I think it's vital that we have a phone here at the station. And frankly, there are other problems developing too. We need money to pay utilities. There's a huge utilities bill in the building where we operate. And there's also a rent problem. And these are real issues which come up like once every 2 weeks at the Free Radio Santa Cruz meeting. I guess the next Free Radio Santa Cruz meeting is going to be Sunday at 7 at Ed Fry's office, which is right across from the Bagelry on Maple and Center Streets. No, Cedar Streets. Maple and Cedar. So that's 7 o'clock Sunday, day after tomorrow. You can come to the meeting and bring your wallet, your checkbook, you know, your wampum, anything of value with you, because if the bills don't get paid, this station goes under. I mean, I don't want to sound like KPFA on a fundraising drive or some national public radio station, but it is in fact true. It won't be here. I won't be able to do another show. It'll be gone, and we'll be able to, you know, look at each other and blame each other about who didn't do the right thing. So let's not do that. Give a call to me at Huff if nothing else at 423-4833, and I'll put you in touch with, you know, who to give your $1,000 checks to, or $5 checks to, or quarters to, whatever you got. We need money today by 5 o'clock to pay the phone bill. Is that clear, folks? By 5 o'clock today. If you want to hear the station tomorrow, in the sense of hearing anybody call in, get your checks in today. So again, the number to call to discuss this and to talk about what D-Bob is talking about, which is a problem of lack of motivation, Food Not Bombs, and some problems with people not showing up to help them. And if you have some personal discussions or issues, or not necessarily personal issues, but professional issues with D-Bob, he's here in the studio to talk to you about these and to talk to the community at large. 427-3772.
Go ahead. Mention cooking on Saturday.
You want to mention... on Saturday, you need some cooks? Is that what's happening? Or I'm sorry, I'm missing this. Go ahead. Why don't you mention it?
Just an announcement regarding Saturday cooking. It looks like rain is quite possible tomorrow, so we rely on an indoor kitchen. A household kitchen on Hebert Street has volunteered for every other Saturday. We used it last Saturday, so we would have to clear it with them for this Saturday. If they can't accommodate it, the meal probably won't happen because I don't know of another kitchen. Cooking Sunday is at 608 Mission Street.
So at 608 Mission on Sunday, about what time?
9 o'clock for cooking.
9 o'clock in the morning. If you want to show up there, you can certainly help Food Not Bombs. Chop those carrots, slice those bits of celery, and throw the cucumbers into the stew, and that goes out to serve dozens of people who don't have food. And that's particularly nice in cold, wet weather to have a nice hot soup. And while I'm on the air, I would like to tip my hat to other food serving organizations like Feed the People Downtown, which is serving, 4 or 5 days a week down there at Cathcart and Pacific, and Sean's and John Earth are also involved with that. I want to thank them and the people who are involved with that organization and encourage you to support them as well. Give a call to 427-3772 if you want to discuss these issues or if you want to discuss other issues of civil rights and the poor. We're going to turn now briefly to an interview that I found very interesting with a man you don't hear from much, but actually a man who I saw on the street about an hour ago. He's Rolling Thunder Mike Sheridan of the River Street Refugees. In fact, he's entering the studio right now as we speak. What a coincidence. He and a couple of his cohorts from the River Street Refugees, which, as you know, the group that was firmly deported by Mayor Mike Rotkin to New Brighton Beach as a sort of a Christmas gift. And they've been bouncing around from campground to campground, making their way, paying their own way, and they bounced to another campground, as far as I know, recently. I don't even have to play the tape. I have a tape here of Mike Sheridan, who I used to describe as Rolling Thunder Mike back in the fall when we were all kind of fighting for the Coral Street Open Air Shelter's existence. He's here in the studio. He can speak for himself. Well, Mike, we can begin to play the tape. Which would you prefer? You want to hear a little bit of the tape? Well, here's a little bit of the tape, and then if anybody wants to call in, we can, you know, you can talk to Mike live along with
Sam,
with, Sam who's been doing who's been doing serious research around the county and looking for a campground in the county. Let's hear a little bit of Mike in his own venue out at New Brighton Beach. I guess that was before he was moved or had to move to another venue. I guess what, Cowell?
Henry Cowell.
Let's hear what Mike had to say. And of course, he's here if you want to ask him any questions. 427-3772. Let's get that tape in there, and away we will roll.
Well, it's still Valentine's Day, 20 to 3, and I'm out here at the New Brighton Beach Campground, talking to a sturdy camper and a chain smoker, Rolling Thunder Mike Sheridan. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Bob.
Now, Mike is a man of few words.
Big Bob.
Actually,
Skid Row Bob.
No, this is Uncle Robert. It's Skid Marks Bob you're thinking of. He's the Just Kidding Band downtown, and a fine fellow he is. Now, Mike, you're about to move this camper.
Is this on the air now?
You should be on the air about this point, yes.
This is being recorded. You're going to be, people are going to hear this?
People are going to see the kind of high intellect and rapid lightning response time that you have here, Rolling Thunder. Exactly. Now, this camp should be moving, what, tomorrow, the next day, to some new spot. Is that correct?
Yeah, tomorrow we're going to make another jump, just like frogs.
Out of the frying pan and into the beach or something?
From one pot pond to another, from one weary trail to another, from one remote place in the state parks to another. We've gotten the whole tour of state parks pretty much, or we could, in this area in the last 2 months.
Now, how are you financing this tour? Are the taxpayers paying good money for you to run around and soak up taxpayer dollars?
No, not at all. We each of us pay our own rent, $5 a week. And then we put in $10 for food in food stamps, or $5 in cash each. And so far that's been self-sustaining.
You've had some new additions to the camp in the last couple of weeks, as well as some folks who've left. How large is the camp, and what is your sense of how it's going out?
Well, officially we're at 16 people now, and originally we were 42 in December when we left the back 40. A lot of jokers are gone. A lot of druggies and alkies have gone to jail. One person died by their own hand, OD. When when the money ran, it started running out, and the donations and the taxpayers' money, they spent $1,500 on setting us up here through Christmas and New Year's. When that all stopped and the party stopped and the money ran out, a lot of people just left.
But some have remained.
Right. Yeah. And there are seasoned people here who've endured the winter and shown that the homeless can maintain a community throughout a California winter outdoors. I mean, people understand that intellectually, that of course they can do that. They know individuals who've stayed out through California winters. American Indians lived with light shelter and clothing through the California winters for, who knows, centuries possibly. That, well, anyway, we've done it and shown that it can be done by the homeless, and also maintain a campground and feed ourselves and stay healthy to a relative degree with a lot of obstacles and hardships and difficulties involved. But we've done that. The people in this county that are opposed to campgrounds for the homeless need to understand from our experience that it can be done in a constructive and healthy way, whether it's been done in the past or not. So we may be going to Henry Cowell, we may be going to Sunset, we still have time, but this will be our last day at Brighton. We have two more days we can use here, and we may use that as the jump, where you have to do 7 days or 14 days in a state park, and then you have to go away for 2 days. And you can normally do 30 days in any given state park with a two-day break in between.
Now, didn't you have a, sort of a strange incident that occurred while you were in town? Some park ranger with a gun on their hip came out here and threatened to have you all removed with truckloads of park rangers today if you weren't out by noon, something like that?
Yeah, this little woman, this Hispanic woman with a gun, came out here in a uniform and told us at 11:30 this morning that if we don't get out of here by noon, she's going to have a truckload of men come out here and take all our things away. And she was threatening us, you know, with what constitutes, you know, forced eviction. But unfortunately, she had her days mixed up, and she thought we were supposed to be out by today, but our rent's paid until tomorrow at noon when we'll be leaving. But she had no business threatening us, and that shows an underlying hostility that has existed on the part of some rangers in the state park system, whereas others, both rangers and staff, have been very friendly and polite and, you know, even kind to us. And we get along with some of them very well. Some we don't. And they seem to be on personal crusades. And this is not the first instance. They wrongfully impounded one of our people's trucks the last time we were here. And he's gone to court on that, and the district attorney dropped the charges because the ranger acted improperly in making an illegal search and seizure, which she had no right to do.
Same ranger?
No, it's a different ranger. She was like the chief ranger over here, I think. And of course, she's been reprimanded for that and smarting from that. They've said that this guy who owned the truck, John, can't come back in here anymore.
Now, I spoke to a Barbara Riverwoman, who's a community activist who supports your campground, and she told me that I presented this account to her, largely the same one you just gave me. She said, oh no, this man was kicked out because he was drunk. That's what Barbara said.
He was arrested for being drunk, but no charges were ever filed against him. He just had a bad time, and he was going through tremendous anger and depression alternately from day to day about his truck being taken, which is a condition that the rangers had no business doing in the first place, or creating in the first place. They caused him incredible grief. They really did. He was around camp a lot, you know, really unhappy and miserable over this, and talking about getting his truck back. And it caused him a lot of mental stress. That's not an exaggeration. So one night he got drunk, and all that anger and hostility he was holding inside came out. And I think that they're taking his truck was part and parcel of, you know, his frustration and, you know, blowing off steam that he did. He didn't hurt anybody.
Well, everyone said he assaulted someone. Is that correct?
No.
So she was wrong in that respect.
Right. He didn't assault anybody.
He didn't strike anyone.
He was subdued at the time that the police came. he had already calmed down, and he was quite lucid, and they took him away for a few hours and let him go, and he came back. So we're not sure that they're not making up laws here. I mean, the man was never charged with being drunk. He caused no harm to others, etc. Again, I think there's something personal going on the part of this ranger and John. And
John is the man in question.
Right. And I can understand John feeling personal about it and angry personally, but I think that the rangers in both of these cases have lost a sense of their job description here, and what that entails, and they're becoming personal in some of their actions, and that's, where police violence, police crimes against people and injustices begin.
Has Sean been excluded from the camp by the rangers and he's no longer with you?
Yeah, he hasn't challenged that. He's been staying downtown and busy trying to get his truck back. They're still going to put him through some hoops about that. They won't give it back to him easily. But like I said, that's some of the rangers, and that's not all the rangers. So people have to understand that. And some of these rangers are going on personal crusades that step go beyond the bounds of what the rules for the state park systems are, or what their job is.
Those who are homeless or without a lot of money seem to me to be doubly vulnerable to this kind of misconduct on the part of rangers or police, particularly rangers who control the they're sort of like the landlords of the parks.
Well, yeah, they're like the zookeepers too, they're the guards and the jailers. But we see the people coming in with their $50,000 and $100,000 rigs, like this last weekend when the weather broke and they opened up the South Loop. So within 3 hours, every space was rented out with very exclusive motorhomes and people who barely, get out of them except to polish them or sit on lawn chairs, right next to the trailer. They came out here to play, and that's pretty much what people in the state parks who run them, the rangers or maintenance, are used to seeing, that poor people like this week have come in during the week, but it's part of how they're living from hand to mouth often. And there are a lot of people living in vehicles, both the wealthy ones, hundreds of thousands in automobile clubs. Hundreds of thousands of people at any given time are living on wheels in America. And among those, there are tens of thousands of homeless, gypsies, and nomads who also live in vehicles, trailers, vans, campers,
cars.
Yeah, we've met people who, use the parks, and they're smart because they can do it for half the price of a motel room. And if they have the disabled card, they can do it for half that price again. And it's a healthier place to be than downtown on, the row with all the motels and all the noise and stuff, and it's cheaper. But unfortunately, most homeless and poor people haven't figured that out yet or taken advantage of the park systems. And they think, some parks cost more than others, that's true. But so for a variety of those reasons, fewer people, mostly the people with money and affluence, come to the state parks and use them to play. But not so many poor people. And poor people are a little dirtier and a little raggedier. And the rangers and maintenance are used to very polite people who don't get out of their vehicles, and they don't wander around too much, and they don't live. Well, we live here. And we've lived in the state parks now for 2 months. And it's not a playland to us. We do it out of love of outdoors, love of the wildlife around us and the natural life around us for what it is, It's part systemic still. We're close to a freeway here, but it's partly natural.
You also were driven out of Santa Cruz, were you not?
We're also driven out of Santa Cruz.
And you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz on the air with Bathurst Spear, Robert Norris. You've been listening to Mike Sheridan, a River Street refugee, camper, man of the outdoors, and well-spoken, articulate advocate, whose interview is going to continue, along with commentary by other campers who are in and out of the studio. I see most of them are out, but we have Dragon's Heart Dan, who's in, and I guess Sam I Am should be back, as well as two other campers. But before we do, And you can, of course, call in at 427-3772. That's 427-FRSC. This is 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have, as promised, Jessica Miller. And Jessica is a student from UCSC, a community activist, and a woman I met at the Board of Supervisors meeting about 3 weeks ago when she and quite a few other UCSC students spoke against the proposed youth protection curfew, as they call it. Sign in, Jessica, and tell us something about how you got involved with this stuff.
I'm involved with the Student Union Assembly up at the university. My position is the lobby corps director, so basically I'm responsible for keeping track of legislation on the federal, state, and local level, so this would fall under a local level, being county curfew. We're really concerned about this issue due to numerous reasons. The curfew itself, as whose supervisors Fred Keeley and Marty Wormhout have both stated many times, is a bad idea in that it's a status crime, which would make means that basically due to your age, something is illegal for someone under the age of 18 that's not illegal for someone who's over the age of 18, and that just seems to be a violation of freedoms in and of itself. And I know there are several problems. Personally, one of my biggest concerns is within the definition of tarrying, which is what you would not be allowed to do if you're under the age of 18 between the hours of 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. Within the definition of tarrying, it includes remaining, walking, wandering, strolling without apparent purpose. And I was really concerned about the words without apparent purpose because apparent purpose can mean different things to different people. To me, an apparent purpose, playing is an apparent purpose, having fun is an apparent purpose. So I called, actually, the county council, Dwight Herr, on that, and I asked him, you know, what does this mean? What does without apparent purpose mean? And he didn't seem very ready to give an apparent answer, which I guess is understandable. Most people aren't expected to give legal counsel immediately. But he said that would basically be up to the discretion of the officer, and that he personally would see standing in line would be without an apparent purpose. So I would think the apparent purpose of standing in line would be to get to the front of the line to get to whatever you're trying to do, but that's just a personal
apparently,
thing.
Yes.
Apparently.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, Dwight Herr, who I never knew until by name until, I guess, last Tuesday, he was sitting over by the side of the Board of Supervisors in a suit, kind of an eminence grise, a kind of a gray-haired guy, very distinguished-looking in his suit. I tried to speak to the Board of Supervisors. I came into the curfew debate and found that they didn't seem to be permitting any public discussion. This was actually on Tuesday. The Board of Supervisors had their first real vote on the curfew in terms of initiating it as a law. The first meeting that you and I met at, Jessica, which was, I don't know, you weren't there in September, right? You were there in January. Right. There was actually a meeting on the curfew in September when it first hit the board, and then it was buried in the Sheriff Tracy's office for 4 months, and then it returned to the board in January as a done deal, pretty much. Three of the supervisors were prepared to vote for it, even if it was shown that the sheriff was, you know, I don't know, pulling pubic hair. Well, I don't want to say anything of this sort. That sounds a little inappropriate. Even if the sheriff was, you know, whatever criticisms were raised about that bill, that supervisors seemed ready to just rush right ahead and pass it. But I was impressed by the county council, because after I'd stood there for about 10 minutes looking dolefully at the board, standing in front of the mic, he interrupted the board and said, there's a member of the public who wants to speak, and I've advised him it's probably appropriate. And so then he allowed me to speak, that is to say the chairman of the board, Chairman Simons, followed by a number of other people. Did you speak? I don't think you spoke. You were in the audience, and you spoke earlier, 2 weeks before. Anyway, there were all kinds of important concerns raised at that in the three meetings that the supervisors have heard. In fact, I would say the overwhelming majority of public testimony was against the curfew. Was that your impression, at least on the days you were there?
Definitely. I can recall maybe two or three out of probably the 50 people that spoke being in favor of the curfew. And I know that Dan, who is sitting here also spoke to that last Tuesday about that he was concerned that the county board hadn't listened when it seemed that the overwhelming majority was opposed to the curfew. And I understand, I mean, I would echo that concern. They're elected representatives, therefore they're supposed to listen to their constituents.
Yeah, I was particularly concerned with two issues that I brought to the board again, although I raised a whole bunch more and then issued a printed speech the last time I was at the board meeting. Those two issues were, what are you going to do with people who have no home, per se, in the sense that they live outdoors or in their vehicles? I brought this issue actually to Mark Tracy directly, who finally agreed to have some input on this, and his response and that of his sort of staff sergeant or something, the fellow who would be heading the program which youth would be directed to after they ignored the first warning and then got a second citation, they would be directed to go to a police substation. He said, oh, well, I've only talked to one homeless person in my 15 years in terms of in the county. I've only had one contact with a homeless person, and so we don't get them much out in the county. And I really couldn't believe my ears when I heard that one. I may be misquoting him. Maybe he meant he's only sent one homeless person to jail. But he used the figure one. And it was just baffling to me. And then Mark Tracy admitted, that's our sheriff, he had no program to deal with homeless youth. And that's actually happening up in San Francisco, that kind of problem. San Francisco, under political pressure last summer, passed a youth curfew. They actually raised their 14-year-old youth curfew, I think, to 18. I believe that's correct. And that was because Mayor Juggernaut Jordan, who is now out, now we have Slick Willie Brown, who's in. Jordan was pressing for a nasty, nasty curfew. So the Board of Supervisors, mainly liberals, decided to do a Clinton and beat him to the punch and pass their own curfew, right? Clinton has dismayed, conservatives everywhere by essentially becoming conservative and removing their need to even oppose him, because Clinton takes over their agenda frequently. Anyway, that may be as it may, but up in San Francisco, I was talking today to Keith McHenry, a Food Not Bombs activist. He's pointed out that the curfew has really been an utter failure in terms that the Board of Supervisors has proposed it. There has been no facilities to take youth to other than juvenile hall, and it was repeatedly stated by the sheriff and by the district attorney and by the three supervisors who favor this curfew here in Santa Cruz, that the juveniles would not get a record, that they would not be sent to juvenile hall, that they would not be incarcerated and face contact with, let us say, more hardened criminals or more experienced criminals. That no, this would simply be, they'll have to write an essay about how I've been a bad girl by violating the curfew, that sort of thing. And I'm not saying that isn't going to happen, but in San Francisco it isn't happening. In San Francisco, cops are using it to stop people that look under 18. In San Jose, they're using it to stop Hispanics disproportionately. And the question is, and this is another thing the sheriff never answered, what are the safeguards that we have that will make sure that doesn't happen here? And Tracy's response was, we're all fair and honest police officers here, and that wouldn't happen here. And so then I moved on to the next question. Yeah, Trust, you want to comment on anything I'm saying, Jessica?
Oh, I was just, when he was talking about what did the sheriff have to respond about that, it was just, trust me, oh, don't worry, it's not going to happen. I personally don't have that much faith in that. Just knowing how people are and what happens and the preconceived notions people have about the way people look or the color of someone's skin, that it might not be intentionally doing it, but it's there in their minds, and therefore it'll be shown by who's affected by this ordinance. The other thing that seems pretty interesting to me is that that we brought up when we went to the first public hearing that happened in January was the effect that it's going to have on other people besides those that are under 18 who are violating the curfew as it would stand on the books. Would be, and of course this is of great concern to me being a university student and to a lot of other university students. I've had people look at me and think that I was too young to drive a car, and I'm 19 years old. So, I mean, how is anyone supposed to be able to tell by looking at me if I'm over 18 or under 18? And I know that in the city of Santa Cruz this will not be in effect due to the city council not being as stupid. But on this issue,
not sure any will about the police chief. The police chief, Chief Belcher, confided to me that hey, he wants a curfew in the city.
Oh, I know. I was at the meeting, and I was a little concerned for a minute, but it actually turned out for the best, because they did talk about, this is within the City Council of Santa Cruz, they talked about what programs are available for youths to go to, why are they just hanging out on the streets, maybe causing problems, maybe not, but why are they out there, and they directed the police chief to look and see what programs were available, which I think is a step even farther than just saying you don't want a curfew. I think that's trying to address like what problems that the curfew wanted to address but probably won't. So I think that that's a good step in the city. And I wish the county had done the same.
Yeah, well, that's been one of the other criticisms that I've levied against the county curfew. I mean, I am an inveterate opponent of curfews, and Mark Tracy has said to me, well, no matter what we do, we can't please you if we have a curfew. And that's true. I think that's probably true. Unless we've got, you know, snipers shooting down in Sarajevo, I don't particularly want a curfew downtown. I don't think it's helpful. I think it's an attempt to, preempt parents' rights. I think it involves the state in criminalizing a whole class of conduct which should not be criminalized per se. I think it gives police great unbridled discretion that they should not have. Police officers are investigating a crime, and there's a suspicious person, however old she or he is. Yeah, you know, you ask that person what's going on, you have a legitimate reason to stop and interrogate that person. But if everybody who looks under 18 becomes fair game for police stops, we got trouble, folks. We got lots of trouble. The fact that Sheriff Tracy says he wants to be fair about it, frankly, doesn't reassure me a whit. I mean, it's not Sheriff Tracy who's going to be stopping all these people on the streets. You know, if you're in a car, you can be stopped, you know, if you're driving to and from. And I'm reminded again of at least two cases where existing curfews have resulted in ridiculous situations. In Capitola, activist Star Underwood, who was pregnant, and she's had her baby since, and she's underage, sent out two friends to get her some milk in Scotts Valley. She was the first speaker, you may remember, Jessica, in the early January at the Board of Supervisors.
Yeah, I do remember that. In fact, I was talking to her during the break, and she said that she had sent her boyfriend out to get her some milk for her baby, and he was stopped just for being under the age when she couldn't move her home since she had a young child to attend to. So I am concerned about the implications of this whole implementation.
Yeah, not only was he and his friend stopped, they were sent home to Boulder Creek and another distant community, and she didn't get any milk that night. So, I mean, you might say, well, you know, maybe the mother should have sent a note with them. It should have been, you know, done more one way or another. But we're talking about, you know, the normal conduct of human affairs, and this seems to me to be throwing all kinds of bizarre roadblocks up. You know, it's like you have to show your pass, or you go, wait, is this some sort of, you know, wartime zone for the young? You're treating the young as though they're, you know, they're combat veterans, or though there's some sort of national crisis. Again, broadcasting police priorities instead of social priorities, I think, intimidates, creates a repressive and chilling climate, distorts what goes on, and indeed turns young people against authority rather than allowing for the kind of cooperation with legitimate authority that we need.
I would agree. Another thing that strikes me as rather interesting is the person on the board who tends to be fairly moderate, so is a swing vote, Jan Buttes. She used personal examples rather than maybe irrefutable evidence to justify why she was in favor of it. Anyone can cite a personal example that says anything one way or another, so I found that kind of offensive in and of itself. But she said that she was concerned about the increase of graffiti in her neighborhood and that kind of thing. And I would like to know, you know, and I did bring this up when I spoke, is that, you know, what proof do you have that people under the age of 18 are the ones who are doing that? So, and if they are, you know, graffitiing something, that's already illegal. You don't need a law to keep people inside who aren't doing something that's illegal. So, it seems to me that if you wanted to go out and do something illegal, knowing that there's a curfew on the street is not going to keep you inside either.
Yeah, I mean, there were many things we brought up. Another two women who didn't make it to the meeting I interviewed on the streets, Peggy in Jamaica. Jamaica is a dark-skinned daughter of Peggy, who's very fair complexion, and Jamaica's about 19 or 20.
Santa Cruz.
Just got your signal back.
Okay.
Your signal was lost for 60 seconds or so.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, caller. Anything you want to say about this issue?
I haven't read the ordinance, but it looks like it's just a... I was standing there after we were speaking in a circle with Art Danner, the district attorney, and he was agreeing with me, nodding his head vigorously, that I thought the ordinance was just a way to get people who are unaware of their constitutional rights to waive them, because if you are underage and are carded, and they'll threaten you with 6 months of jail if you don't take probation, and then they'll begin the story-taking and the misreporting that goes on in order to get people, young people especially, who they believe are committing these horrible graffiti crimes and other crimes perhaps, used to the idea of, well, first of all, unaware of their rights, that they don't have to say anything to anybody about anything, but under threat of jail 6 months that they do get tied into some kind of mentor or diversion program, but, you know, under threat of jail 6 months if they don't take it.
Mm-hmm.
And that they get used to just spilling their guts out to somebody who can incriminate them by simply misreporting or misrepresenting what they're stating, and forego all the real strict and stringent requirements of evidence that would be required if they, if any offense is taken to a trial.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, caller.
Sure.
All right.
I remember that conversation with Art Danner. I'm sorry we lost the signal. I think our mic came out there. Sorry, folks have been listening in. We are talking about the curfew with Jessica Miller on Bathrop Spears Broadsides, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And you can call and join in this discussion at 427-3772. Art Danner was indeed at the last meeting of the Board of Supervisors and did testify before the board, because the other concern I raised was this is a misdemeanor. That's all this law says. And indeed, Marty Wernhardt put this concern...